And this is Seattle's Morning News, Wednesday morning. A longtime figure in the civic and cultural history of Tacoma, and really the entire state, is finally getting the recognition she deserves. And so our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, went to find out about the life and times and the 1880s historic home of Nettie Asbury. Felix brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, I went to the hilltop section of Tacoma a few days ago to look at an old Victorian house built in 1887. That's a couple years before statehood. You know, it's seen better days, that house, but it's got good bones, as they say. And it was the home for 63 years of Nettie Asbury, a black woman who died in 1968 at the remarkable age of 103. Nettie Asbury is experiencing something of a rehabilitation lately, becoming as well-known and lauded as she deserves to be. Her old house, which also has a music room and a huge yard, is going to need some rehabilitation, too.
So they're going to lift the house up, repair the foundation, and then put the house back down. And they can sit it here in the yard, I guess. I don't know how they do it.
That's a great yard.
Yeah. Now, she used to have concerts because she was a musician. So she had concerts in this yard all the time, quite a bit.
That was Cynthia Tucker. She's president of a group called the Tacoma City Association of Colored Women's Clubs. They've been called that since 1944, but they go back further than that. With funding from the state of Washington, the nonprofit bought the house late last year and is beginning the process to restore it and create a museum and cultural center. Now, Nettie Asbury is one of the founders of the Tacoma Group back in 1908 when it was called the Cloverleaf Arts Club. That's when Asbury was traveling around the state and encouraging black women to create civic organizations, which they did a lot of. In a phone call before my visit, Cynthia Tucker told me about some of Nettie Asbury's accomplishments.
She also founded the first NAACP in the state of Washington. She also founded a Red Cross over on this side. Now, since we purchased that house, we have a lot of people bringing up her information, researching who she was, what she did. They got college students writing reports. All kinds of things are happening under her name.
Now, the Tacoma City Association of Colored Women's Clubs has accomplished a lot in the past century, but restoring the Nettie Asbury House is their biggest project ever. Now, Wanda Thompson's involved in the project. She's a member of the club, just like her mom was before. She says the house is a symbol of Nettie Asbury's past as something of a Renaissance woman, a leader in the black community, a musician, a music teacher, artist, and the old house is key to the club's future, too.
She has a lot of history, and the Asbury House is part of her legacy. It's the home site legacy, and that would be where we would go and tell the story of what she accomplished for this community and for young people in the future to have some place to go and look at their history and be proud of it and not erase it. So she was quite a lady. When I got involved with this project and I started reading a little bit about her, I was amazed that she did all this at that time.
You know, and at that time, Wanda Thompson means the racism and segregation of a century ago, which also was present more recently, too. You know, Thompson's part of a military family who was stationed in Europe before moving to Tacoma in the late 1960s.
When we were looking for homes, I remember as a little girl, my parents were not allowed to look for a home on the north end of Tacoma. They had to stay within the central, which we would call hilltop area, equivalent to the CD area of Seattle. And in the hilltop area, it was not only just African Americans. It was we lived in a neighborhood that was all Italians, so it was a hodgepodge of many cultures. And so they were all kind of railroaded into this one area.
You know, and the club has a lot of money to raise to finish this project, but they did just receive a prestigious grant from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It's $150,000 to support hiring a staff person to help manage the house restoration project. This is Brent Leggs. He's executive director of the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund for the National Trust.
When we learned about the vision of a colored women's club in Tacoma and that they were centering historic preservation at the core of their organizational mission, and that they wanted to take on this difficult task of preserving and opening to the public the home of Nettie Asbury. We wanted to seed investment to affirm that vision and to uplift them for this important work.
And there's a lot of important work to do. Cynthia Tucker and Wanda Thompson say it will take probably 2 years to stabilize the old house, restore the interior, restore the music room where they used to do all these concerts, and make the grounds ready to host concerts again, too. Because it's not just the house that's been declared historic by the city of Tacoma. The yard is as well for all the activities that were held there. So there's a lot to do, but they're very excited about it.
I'm just excited because we've worked so hard for the last about 6 years now, working on trying to get this accomplished. And now we got people lined up who, a lot of volunteers who's, and professionals who want to come in and make this happen, make it a reality, be a part of building this. So it's going to be fabulous and fantastic.
You know, and based on the history and what she accomplished, I told Wanda Thompson that it seems like there should already be buildings named for Nettie Asbury and statues dedicated in her honor.
I agree. Yeah. Yes.
So why aren't there?
We're working on it. That's next.
So there's some money to raise, and we'll have a link at My Northwest where you can find out more information about the project. But what a cool old house right in the middle of Hilltop. Yeah. Nothing's been done to damage it. There's a lot of good bones there. They should be able to create a really cool, sort of just a new asset for Tacoma.
Well, unlike Seattle, Tacoma kept a lot of its downtown area, right? Of its old downtown area, because most of Seattle's seems to have been demolished.
Yeah, and this is a residential neighborhood. Hilltop is just south of downtown Tacoma. Right. So there are lots of old houses in there. Not too many from the pre-statehood era. Something from the 1880s, before 1889. That's a very rare. There's only maybe a handful of these that are on the historic register in the city of Tacoma. But the combination of Nettie Asbury, who she was, in fact, she lived there for more than six decades, is just an incredible intersection of all kinds of history and culture. And the fact they're restoring it and preserving it, what a cool thing.
Felix Spinell, our resident historian, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And joining us now from Seattle Sports 710, here is Mike Sauk on the amazing almost tie game last night between the Mariners and the Yankees. Set this up for us, Mike, for people who missed it.
Wow. I don't know. How much time do we have this morning? Do we have a few hours to talk through this game? I mean, it is one of those types of late season baseball games that takes all day to really unpack. It was October baseball being played in August. Hmm. It was two pitchers that started the game that are among the best in their game, you know, in the game, who were absolutely on it last night.
And this is our new pitcher,
Luis Castillo, who the Mariners traded for a couple of weeks ago at the deadline. The performance he had last night makes me believe he is the best pitcher that we have had here since, obviously, Felix Hernandez in his prime. And I don't really even know who else would come close to what we saw from him last night. 97 and 98 miles an hour for the fastball. He moves it in two directions, the changeup, the slider. I mean, just he has it all, plus the mound presence. He went eight innings of shutout ball. Gerrit Cole went eight innings of shutout ball for the Yankees. Their bullpens went back and forth with guys throwing 100 miles an hour. And it just kept going. And going and going. The Mariners made three or four stellar defensive plays. The Yankees ran themselves into a bunch of outs. Scott Service managed a better game than Aaron Boone did for the Yankees.
I was amazed a couple of times. Both teams would fill the bases and then still not be able to score.
Yeah, and some of that is modern baseball, right, where strikeouts happen a lot more than they used to, right? Batting averages are down. Strikeout numbers are up. More teams wait for a home run or, you know, walk and walk and walk and then home runs. On base percentage becomes a bigger deal than just batting average. And so to get a guy, you know, to third base and then strike out the next two batters is not uncommon in modern baseball. And so you got to see all of that on display last night.
For 13 innings.
For 13
with no
innings.
Score. I mean, that's the incredible thing.
Well, yeah. And certainly the Mariners pitching staff was just on display. I mean, it is just one guy after another since, I think it's about the middle of June, something like that. They essentially have the best bullpen in baseball.
You want to set this play up for us here?
Was this Brash at the end of the 12th, I believe? Maybe it was the 13th. Matt Brash, who is, you know, look, he's a kid. He's a rookie. He came in to start the year as a starter. He walked too many guys. They sent him down to the minors. They turned him in a reliever. And here he is last night in extra innings against this Yankee lineup. And he was just filthy.
1-2 pitch here to Kiner Falefa. The pitch swung on a hit. Oh, backhanded by Matt Brash. He's got the runner hung up between second and third. It's the catcher, Trevino. He's meet. Throw to second. They're going to get him. Here's Frazier. The tag. Got him. Double play. Are you kidding? That was phenomenal.
And there were a couple of times where everything was full. The bases were full. The count was full. And one pitch, one ball would have won the game for the M's.
And they, you know, not only did a ball almost win it, but I think it was in the 11th, maybe it was the 12th. I got to get on my innings straight. Eugenio Suarez was up with the bases loaded. And there was a pitch far enough inside that if he had found a way to not quite move out of the way of that pitch, you win the game. Maybe it's time to wear one, but he didn't. He struck out on the next pitch, and you know, that was they have to go on him. He snapped his bat in half over his knee, and they went off to play another inning.
Night. I guess I did miss a good game.
Oh, it's one of the best, one of the better baseball games I've ever seen. So certainly for August.
Where does this set us up for the rest of the season? Is this again that injection of believing in the blue, and our fans going to start coming out again?
I mean, there were 40,000 people there last night. I don't know how many more fans you needed to see. I mean, fans are out. Fans are paying attention. People are watching the Mariners and caring what's going on with this team. I think there's an investment. You know, look, it's one baseball game out of 162.
That's enough for me.
It took place in August, not in September, not in October. Yeah. So I don't want to oversell its impact. But you did it against the Yankees. They have been one of, if not the best team in the league so far this year. And I would say you know, you got a young team yourself, so wins like this and games like this are important to them for the experience of what it's like to play in them. But as for, hey, does this mean they're, you know, going to win the World Series? No, it's one out of 162. But just as a fan of the game of baseball, last night was beautiful, and it was really fun to watch.
So are there any pitchers left for the game today?
You know, actually, there's some good news on that. First of all, Robbie Ray will start for the Mariners. Day game today. They come right back and have to play at 1 o'clock against the same team they fit. Was that maybe a 13, 14-hour turnaround, something like that? But, you know, look, it's for both teams. The Yankees have the same problem, right, where they used just as many pitchers last night as the Mariners did, only they did it all only to lose, whereas the Mariners, you know, if you're going to spend that ammunition, you better hit the target, and they did.
Mike Sox, Seattle Sports 710. Thank you, Mike.
Of course.
Seattle's Morning News. The U.S. House Committee, held a hearing here in Seattle to focus on economic disparity, and Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott was there.
Committee member and Seattle Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal was happy to tout some of what she says Seattle has done right.
We've raised the minimum wage. We've provided paid sick leave. We've provided the beginnings of a pre-K program. We've got some child care.
Wisconsin Republican and ranking committee member Brian Stile wanted to know the real world impact of such policies.
One of the questions that I have in particular is if it relates to students getting their first job, in particular a summer job.
The panel heard from a series of experts and local business owners, including the owner of Molly Moon's Ice Cream.
I always knew that I wanted to provide living wages and free health care. Over time, I've just added the benefits and programs that I knew would be the most helpful to our workforce. I almost don't like getting praise, and I get a lot of it, for what we do for our employees and for our community. The role of the American government is to provide the safety and opportunity equitably to every American. It shouldn't be up to a company or an employer. A few companies here and there doing the right thing by their employees is not the solution. We all want the American dream. It's not about who you work for or what company you get to start because you have the privilege to start your own company. It's absolutely why I wrote my business plan. I wanted to see if you could make a business profitable.
But an auto shop owner forced out of Seattle had a different take.
Seattle City Council pretty much made it moving forward untenable to try and operate a business in Seattle. You know, all they really did was hurt the, you know, the restaurant industry, the industries that, you know, have, you know, jobs for people to gain job experience, work experience, you know, life skill experience.
Dem State Senator Rebecca Saldana pointed to what she felt were the region's victories.
The slogan was the fight for 15, but Proposition 1 included much more. And from SeaTac, fast food workers and Working Washington marched to Seattle, taking the fight for 15 citywide. The mayor formed a task force, including stakeholders and community leaders like Representative Jayapal, to draft the city ordinance taking effect in 2015. In the meantime, the state legislature failed to act. So in 2016, the coalition launched another statewide ballot initiative and won. This set the stage for 2018 when the Washington State Legislature, with bipartisan leadership, passed the most progressive paid family medical leave program.
But Todd Myers with the Washington Policy Institute pointed to research he says shows the negative aspects of such policies.
You actually saw a reduction in hiring from entry-level, low-skill workers, exactly the types of people that you are talking about. One of the arguments that is made is that the minimum wage saw an increase in productivity. And the reason you see an increase in productivity is because the people who are kept at the higher level are the more productive, more experienced people. The people who need that experience, the people who are entry-level, who are less productive because they are at the beginning of their work experience, are the ones who are left out.
Republicans wanted to know more.
Can you unpack a little bit the hazard pay that temporarily increased the minimum wage to $22 an hour, a pretty significant increase? What was the real-world implications of that for the city of Seattle?
So as I noted that the hazard pay was increased $4 for grocery workers during COVID, the Seattle City Council voted 5-2 to remove that precisely because they were starting to see the negative impacts of that. A local grocery store, QFC, closed a couple of stores, resulting in the layoff of more than 100 people. And as I mentioned,
so grocery stores were closed specifically as a result of increase in wages.
They specifically said that the policy was why they ended up closing the stores.
Jayapal pushed back on the criticism of some of the policies.
There was a Brookings report that said that large grocery and retail chains, including Kroger, found profits increased by $17.7 billion over the first three quarters of 2020 and saw a 10% sales increase in the fourth quarter of 2020. How is it possible that there would be any argument on the table that these grocery stores closed because they couldn't afford it? I really needed to challenge that because I find it incomprehensible that argument would be made at the same time that these grocery stores are putting all this money into stock buybacks.
So that was a robust discussion. Hannah, what was the goal of the hearing?
So the goal, this is one of several cities that they stopped in. I think they've been to a city in Ohio and in Texas. And what they're doing is getting information about some of the local programs. And then at the end of this Congress, they will be issuing a report with recommendations on what works that perhaps could be looked at maybe a national scale is the general idea here. So I wasn't clear which policies were working and were not. I think you had some differences of opinion there, depending on who you talk to on this panel. I do want to note one thing that the chair told me, Jim Hines, was that overall, because they had been here for a couple of days, they met with the Chamber of Commerce and things, and they said, despite all of these programs, the overwhelming issue here in Seattle and in a lot of cities is the lack of affordable housing. So until we can fix that, there's not a lot that is going to make a big difference.
So were there business people there, and did they say that these policies made Seattle more or less business friendly?
There were what you heard there at the beginning from Molly Moons and that auto dealer who's now in Kirkland, or auto shop repair, I should say, who's now in Kirkland, having been driven out of Seattle, was a video statement. So they weren't there in person, but they had a statement for this panel specifically. And you heard Molly Moons was talking about how she was able, with her business model, to pay well on her own, right? Mm-hmm. So she's had employees who stayed there for like 10, 12 years, but that government should be responsible for making that equitable, fair pay for everybody, not individual business owners who can afford it. And then the negative there, of course, from that auto shop dealer.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. I hope you've seen this one. If not, let's listen to it. A moment in Little League greatness, capturing hearts around the internet. During the Southwest Regional Playoff Final in Waco, Texas, pitcher Caden Shelton was facing batter Isaiah Jarvis when a ball got away from him and hit Isaiah in the helmet.
Oh, look out.
The young man fell to the ground, clutching his head as his concerned coaches ran to his aid. Eventually, though, he made it to first base, and cameras were focused on him. But he was looking at Caden, who stood on the mound, staring at the ground, tears in his eyes. That's when Isaiah tossed his helmet to the side and walks towards the forlorn pitcher.
So this is really cool, because as a pitcher, Bubs looks shaken up right now. because of what he did. And look at Zay Jarvis. This is such great sportsmanship. He wants him to know that it's okay, that he'll be fine.
Hey, bud. Look at me. Look at me. You're all right.
Amazing.
You're all right. Look at me.
It's hard to hear at the end, but Isaiah says, "Hey, you're doing great. Let's go." He comforts the pitcher who accidentally hit him. The gesture drew a standing ovation.
That is a great video.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the video. I think the pitch hit him under the helmet.
It hit the side of the helmet.
It hit right there by the ear hole and knocked the helmet off.
Yeah.
It kind of came up to the side.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a great gesture. You're right.
/7:48 from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo News Radio. It's G. Scott. Hey, buddy.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. What's happening?
Well, we wanted to talk about this, and I know this piqued your interest as well. It's one of those viral stories, not necessarily new, but because it hit viral status, 147,000 people just found out about it. It's a Yale study of preschool teachers told to watch a video of students and be on the lookout for misbehavior. Except the researchers were studying the teachers and their eye movements, and there was no misbehavior. But what they found, the teachers focused in on students of color. Your reaction to this study?
Not surprised, but I love to talk about this because I think that this is the best way forward. The reason why that this topic and this discussion, and by the way, you know, like you said, in this survey, there weren't just white teachers. There were black teachers, too, right, that were part of this. And all of them were focused on the little black child in there. And I think one of the things that we don't do is we don't talk about our unconscious biases, right? And mm-hmm. and why they exist. And I told James a story yesterday, and I feel like I have to tell this today. In eighth grade, when I was in military school, I got kicked out of class. Shocker, right? Anyway, I got kicked out of class. But when I got kicked out of class, I had to go to the principal's office. And the principal was by a man by the name of Mr. Piper. May he rest in peace. Mr. Piper, I loved him because he was back in Indiana in the 50s. He was like a basketball legend. Like even during that time, like he was known as like the bat, and basketball is a big deal in Indiana. So I'm going down to his office. He says, "Scott, get on in here." So I'm in there and he says, "So you got kicked out of class, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, but I got kicked out of class, but no, not this time. Like, this wasn't fair." And I don't know if he like whether he believed me, but he said something to me. And to this day, I've never forgot about it ever. And he said, "Scott, do you ever feel like sometimes things aren't fair? You ever feel that in your heart where you're in a situation and maybe right now you ever feel like something's not right? It's not fair." And I said, "Yeah, that's exactly how I feel right now, because this is not fair. This is wrong." And I said, and I told him, I said, "Now, times that I've gotten in trouble in the past, okay, that's one thing, but this particular time, no." And he says, "Well, I want you to know something. That feeling that you have, you're right. You're right about that. And the truth is, it's not fair. It hasn't been fair. And there's a lot of things for you, because you are black, you're going to have to properly deal with this for the rest of your life. Now, what are you going to do?" And so what was so important about this discussion, here I am, 14 years old, and this older gentleman, white man, is telling me and having this discussion with me. But it was the best thing that's ever happened to me, because I got to understand early on that, yes, you're right. That feeling of unfairness, you're right about that. And you're going to continue to feel that way. And it's going to continue to be in situations where things are unfair. So now what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't go, like, no matter what, we only have a certain amount of time on earth. And at the end, when it's time to go, you get ready to leave. Hey, what was your biggest takeaway while you're on earth? Things were unfair. Well, you know what? Fair is subjective. A lot of people have situations where things are unfair. You're born in a situation where things are unfair. Life, things can be unfair. But
so wait a minute, G, are you saying then just accept it?
No.
Don't push back. Don't protest.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying you recognize it and you talk about it. And in this case right here, in this study, I'm glad it happened because now we can talk about these things. Because for so many years, people wanted to pretend like, no, 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 everything's fair. Yeah. That's not true.
I'm colorblind.
I don't see anything. I don't see color.
Yeah.
No, no, no. I'm a preschool teacher. I look at all the kids the same. Those are my babies. No, I'm not saying to accept life that way. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the more we talk about these things, the better we get. And one of the biggest tragedies in America that we have done, if we've said things like we don't see color, and we've said things like, oh, it's not the right time to talk about these things. And so, and right now, and if you're saying, I get uncomfortable when we talk about race, then that's the problem.
What about firing somebody for unconscious bias? Because we just had that case out of Kent where... Now, this was a little bit more overt. The teacher called the third grade girl ratchet and ghetto on the, and she got transferred to a different elementary school. And the child's aunt is saying she should have her teaching license revoked.
2022, and you have a professional that's teaching kids saying things like ratchet and ghetto. That's a little bit different than staring at little kids with unconscious bias.
So sometime canceling is necessary. Other times, let's just talk about our unconscious bias.
Let's talk about
it. All right.
But that teacher needs to be fired.
Okay.
I don't care what nobody says. You know what I mean? 2022, ratchet, ghetto, fired. This profession is not for you.
All right. G. Scott from the G and Ursula Show starts right at 9 o'clock. One of my favorite shows on this radio station. Thanks, G.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. When Joe Biden was elected president, we learned that he had a stuttering problem, which he overcame, and overcame pretty well since he became president. But stuttering is something that affects a significant portion of the population. And Jane Fraser is the president of the Stuttering Foundation. How did you get into this line of work, by the way? What made you interested in stuttering?
Well, I was actually born into it. My father stuttered quite severely, and he actually started this foundation 75 years ago. So so you can say I was born into my job.
And has there been, I mean, I'm fascinated by the way the brain works. What have we learned about stuttering since you started your research?
I don't think people realize how complex it is to say a word. 45,000 neuromuscular events take place just to say one word. So there is a lot going on. So it's not surprising that for some people, it's a little more difficult than for others. Just like for some kids, they can hit a basketball basket beautifully. Other kids may struggle a little bit more as they learn how to talk. So there's a broad array of some people going to be announcers like you, and other people are not ever going to have that degree of fluency. We're all along a continuum somewhere. But yes, it's the most complex thing we do. And as you know, it's what makes us different from other animals is the fact that we can speak when we do communicate. That's what makes us human.
What I've seen, especially since stuttering has come to the forefront with President Biden, is this grappling with how we react to somebody who stutters. Obviously, it's being used as political fodder from conservatives to allege that President Biden isn't well, even though it's clear why he's slurring is because he has a stutter and he's talked about it. So why is there such a lack of empathy for something that affects so many people?
Well, I think, you know, we all have always said it's the only disability that people still laugh at. And, you know, there's been Porky Pig it's just really hard to get rid of myths that surround stuttering. There's always people think just because you're not fluent, that you may not be as smart. If you're not fluent, you may not qualify for a job. But we've always found, you know, that people who stutter are actually quite qualified. They often make very good listeners. My father was a wonderful listener and ended up having a tremendously successful business career in the auto parts business. And I think a lot of it was because he stuttered, he gained the confidence of other people. But why people make fun of stuttering, it's just age old, and all the way back to Moses. I do think we're getting on top of that. I think there is more awareness about stuttering. We know that a lot of singers stutter and in fact deal with their stuttering. That's gotten them into their career of singing.
What is it about music, though? There are famous examples of singers who stutter when they speak, but sing normally. Why is that?
That always fascinates people. When you think about it, when you sing, you know the words by heart.
Right.
So you're not, there's no word retrieval problem. There is some evidence that finding the word is part of, some people who stutter have that problem, word retrieval. So when you're singing, you've got the words down. You've also got the rhythm. And we know that the rhythm helps people who stutter. You've also got a different breath control as you sing. The air is coming out in a different way. You're not trying to get a message across. You don't have those. Remember, I said 45,000 neuromuscular events to say one word. Any kind of pressure on that can be disruptive. And so if you're singing, you're not necessarily trying to get a message across.
Do you remember the movie The King's Speech, where
Yes. The
key to it, and this is the reason, I think that movie is the reason, but that my daughter became a speech therapist. They played the music, and the speaker wasn't singing the music, but by playing the music, he was able to speak.
Well, all people who stutter are temporarily helped by distraction. So it could be in that particular situation, the distraction, he's not getting that feedback that makes him tense. He's not hearing himself stutter. So that could be one of the things that is reducing the tension. And the other is he's distracted by the music. There have been, over the years, hearing aid devices that put in white noise into the ears or that use a delayed auditory feedback. Some people who stutter have been helped temporarily, at least, by that auditory feedback. But it also has its drawbacks. Can you understand what's being said to you if you have something in your ears? So, you know, there's no simple answer to that.
And there is no answer still to what causes stuttering or how it develops.
Well, we have a few answers. Dr. Drina found the first three genes that cause stuttering in 2010 and has gone on to find more genes since then. So that's terribly exciting. We do know that about 60% of people who stutter, it runs in their family. So there is a genetic component. We know that, for example, if a child is 2 years old but has a six-year-old vocabulary, we know that that child is kind of out of sync. His motor skills have not yet caught up with his vocabulary. So in those situations, you can reduce the vocabulary. You know, there are ways to help that child, in that case, really outgrow the stuttering. So we do know more, a lot more than we did 75 years ago. Although I must say, the professors in those years made some pretty good guesses about what causality was.
And is there a cure? Could there be someday a cure?
Well, I like to say that, you know, when you deal with the problem with really young children and they learn not to be worried, not to be ashamed of what they're, and they don't continue to stutter, I always refer to that as a cure.
Mm-hmm.
Later in life, if someone's been stuttering for many years, they will certainly get to the point where they can be wonderful communicators. Look at Winston Churchill. Would you consider him a cure?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you would consider him a cure, but maybe he considered it. Maybe Joe Biden considers himself cured in the sense that they are able to communicate what they want to communicate. I think the focus needs to be on, do you have that ability to communicate, not on whether you've, quote, been cured. So I think we just need to shift the focus a little bit.
Jane Fraser is the president of the Stuttering Foundation. Jane, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can ring my bell, ring the bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here's Rachel Bell to explain the virtues of doing nothing.
Yes, this is an article in The Atlantic by Arthur C. Brooks. We've talked about a lot of his articles. He's a Harvard professor, and he uses data and evidence to learn what makes for the happiest life. So according to this article, doing nothing will make you not only happier, it will make your brain work better. So I think we know by now, Americans don't always take all their vacation times. And now with the way technology is, even if you do take a beach vacation, to relax, you might be on your cell phone the whole time, like, you know, looking through social media. And that is not doing nothing as far as the way that our brains work and thrive. So Arthur Brooks says, quote, "For the sake of happiness, strivers and hardworking work machines of any income level need to learn to stop. If you are in this category, nothing should be higher on your to-do list than to make sure you make time to do nothing." So I guess back in the day, and this is my specialty, I am so good at this. Like, I'm not lazy. I don't sit around doing nothing. But this whole idea of, like, not taking your vacation, not relaxing, like, what's wrong with America? Like, it comes so easy to me.
Well, you already said what's wrong with America in that you equated doing nothing to being lazy. There's a difference, between doing nothing, being lazy, and enjoying leisurely time.
Yes.
And I think that's where our vernacular has gotten mixed up, where we go, oh, yeah, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not productive. I'm lazy. And it's like, no, you're being a human. You're enjoying this life we've been given.
Yeah, you're relaxing. So it even said, like, when the pandemic started and everybody was working from home and we had all this commute time that we could spend however we wanted, people worked during that time. It said the average workday increased by 48.5 minutes. So this is interesting. Our brain chemistry is tuned for constant entertainment. And it says, as a result, idleness is extremely uncomfortable. There was a 2014 study where people were left alone in a room for anywhere from 6 to 15 minutes and they were supposed to do nothing. And they got so bored and itchy to do something, many of them administered painful electric shocks to themselves just so they could have something to do. I guess they must have...
They gave them a button?
I guess.
Well, there's your problem. Don't give people buttons that allow them to shock themselves.
How do you not press a button when you're sitting in a room with a button, right?
I wonder what this does. Yeah. So how are you both at this? I know, Colleen, you've talked a lot about the fact that you've struggled with workaholism.
Yeah.
Recovering workaholic.
Capital W workaholism, right? In the last year, I've tried to reverse that. And I realized, like, it got to the point where, you know, you meet an alcoholic and they say, yeah, I can't even drive by my favorite bar because I'll be too tempted. Others, they say, no, it's fine. Drink around me. I don't mind. I was super worried when I came back to work after my break that I wouldn't know how to enter this building and not overwork because that's the way my brain had been programmed, that productivity equaled worth. My worth as a human was tied to how productive I was. And I had to reverse that by choosing a different definition of productivity. Like, I connected with my child. That's productive. It's not earning me money, but it is making me happier. So
you describe, you would consider work anything that's directly involved in earning money.
Though. Yes.
So like when I spend an afternoon doing home maintenance, is that considered idle time?
Do you enjoy it?
Yeah.
Then sure.
Well, according to this article, there's like two ways to do it. Because according to this article, sometimes that's not quite idle enough. Like, they want you to actually really do nothing. But then there's the kind of doing nothing where you're doing a light activity that allows your mind to flow and breathe.
Here's a question for Dave. Do you feel guilty when you take a nap?
No.
Then he has mastered the art of being idle because... Yeah. Naps to me used to be, oh my God, I'd be cleaning the house.
Yeah.
Even if it's 20 minutes, I could be doing something. And now I make it a point to take a nap every day.
If I needed, now I don't need to take a nap every day, but if I need to take one and I ignore it, then I can't clean the house. I can't be productive. So, I mean, maybe it doesn't count because the reason I take the nap is because I know when I wake up, I will be able to do something useful.
I liked the idea of taking a vacation with no itinerary. I've done that a couple of times, of course, in locations where it's easy not to have an itinerary, like the Washington coast. And it is uncomfortable not to have plans. But it's also freeing when you realize, oh, I still had fun without plans.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if the whole goal is happiness, for me, planning my vacation brings me happiness because I get to do all of these things that I really want to do. So I just got back from vacation. This is like my second day back to work. And I was gone for 2 weeks. I did a ton of hiking in Southwest Colorado and Utah and Crater Lake. And I don't check email. I don't go on social media at all. And for most of the trip, I didn't have reception. So I hardly even texted.
So great.
So even though I had a bunch of plans for hiking and being outside and we were van camping and like having to do cleaning up and stuff, I feel super clear headed and free and revitalized. So it was like a really good combo.
Nice.
Planned out, but also free.
Yeah. To me, hiking doesn't count as doing nothing. Hiking is hiking. I mean, it's exercise. It's observing. It's sometimes challenging yourself.
Yeah. What if you hiked really slow and intentionally?
Like forest bathing?
Oh, like forest bathing. Yeah. And breathe in the terpenes.
Well, forest bathing is nice, but there better be a view at the end of the bath. That's all I'm saying.
Besides your toes?
Yeah. If I don't get a view, if I don't get a summit somewhere, then I count that a wasted hike.
I like that as the name of your memoir, A Summit Somewhere.
Yeah.
By Dave.
Or
Ross.
A Bath with a View.
Yeah. Don't Look Down is the subtitle.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.